As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TiVo Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie, and once again, I am not joined by my good friend and producer Mike Zimmerman, but I am joined once again with another fantastic guest for this episode, because today we're going to talk all things Ange Postecoglou with Nathan Clark of the Extra Inch Podcast. Now, I spoke to Nathan 6 months ago at the very beginning of the Ange Postecoglou project at Spurs, and what we do in this episode is we look back over those 6 months, see where Postecoglou has Spurs at 6 months later, and we have a little bit of a think about the Postecoglou project going forward. But as always, every moment where I'm speaking in the intro is a moment where we're not listening to the guests themselves. So without further ado, let's get over to Nathan Clark and the future of Ange Postecoglou's Tottenham Hotspur.
Nathan, it is great to have you back on. It's been a long 6 months, it feels like to me, but a lot has happened for Spurs and generally quite good things, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Good timings on both episodes, I would say, is what we've done here.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk in three sections here. We're going to talk about what happened since we recorded about 6 months ago. We're going to talk about some of the tactical aspects of Ange Ball in the Premier League, and then maybe have a little bit more of a speculative section at the end where we talk about the future. But I think it's worth just summarizing what's happened since we last recorded. So that episode was recorded just before the 2-2 draw with Arsenal. It was actually released after that 2-2 draw. And that was followed by a bit of a winning run, which saw Spurs go to the top of the table. However, it did very quickly become a losing run, I think with 4 losses and a draw in 5 games, which is prompted by a bit of an injury / suspension crisis. That poor streak ended, and it's been a bit more of a mixed bag for Spurs, but they found themselves well on track to finish in the Champions League spots at the end of the season, particularly after that result against Villa recently. So, Nathan, just in terms of the big picture stuff, would you say that the trajectory of the season has followed your expectations or surpassed it?
I guess it depends. It depends exactly when you're asking that setting of expectations, right? Because if you go from, I listened to the first podcast that we did earlier in the season. And at that point, I said, like, the squad's thin. We're probably going to have an injury crisis at some point, and we'll have a downturn, and hopefully we'll recover from that. And that, you know, I feel like I've hit that pretty strongly. But if we went back from, like, before that run of games at the start of the season, coming from the summer, I might be a bit more, not like pessimistic, but like trying to play it safe. I might be a bit like, oh, well, you know, we're losing Harry Kane. We don't know. There's a lot up in the air. It's first, you know, Postecoglou's first season. Things might take some time. So like, yeah, season as a whole, definitely overshooting expectations. But coming from sort of 5 or 6 games into the season, yeah, kind of where I was expecting.
Let's talk a little bit about that, the down part of the season, which we've talked about, that run of 4 losses and a draw in 5 games. How would you explain that, that downtime? Would you say that's purely the result of injuries, or would you say there's maybe something else going on under the surface there?
It's funny, you know, because it's like before the injury crisis came again, I'm on record going, we're probably going to have some difficulties with absentees at some point and a rough patch. And then we have that game against Chelsea in which several players got injured. We get a couple of suspensions. We know that we've got AFCON and Asian Cup coming up. And I go, there's going to be a rough patch now. And then there's a rough patch. And then during it, you start to go, oh, but what if it's more than just the players that we're missing right now? What if it's something else? And then like we start to come to the end of it. We start getting players back. Results aren't immediately back where we want them to be. And you start to go, oh my goodness, maybe it was all a fever dream that we were good to start. And now actually we're rolling back into form and players have had a couple of weeks back and are gelling back again. And we're putting the run together. Mm-hmm. So probably just the absences. Obviously, like, that's not to say there aren't existing weaknesses within the way that we played that weren't exaggerated by those absentees or whatever, but mainly just the injuries, I think.
Yeah. And it is worth saying that in the period since the poor form ended, there have been some points dropped to teams that maybe you would be hoping to have better results against. So I think the teams that you've dropped points to are Brighton, Man United, Everton and Wolves. What do you think that tells us about Spurs from a tactical point of view? Do you think it tells us anything about Spurs from a tactical point of view in terms of maybe the teams that are a bit more vulnerable against?
So let's go through that in order. So the Brighton game, well, we won the most recent Brighton game. The one before that was very much during our injury issue. Not that to say that Brighton didn't give us a difficult game recently. United was a draw. But a 2-2 draw away at United, in which I think it's fair to say we were the better team. I taken much more positives than negatives from that game, right? Whereas Everton and Wolves are probably the ones worth reflecting on. So Wolves played a low block and counter game all game, and that gave us some problems. And the Wolves hit us on the counter, fair enough. Got us sort of pushing too far forward, pushing too hard for a goal that wasn't coming easily. And the thing with that is, like, we can do a whole big deep dive, and maybe we will, into Spurs against the low block and all the difficulties with that, and how we might look to improve on that in the future. But the reality is, the low block and counter is effective, right? And that's why teams do it. And that's why, you know, Man City, who are the best team ever at playing low blocks, still sometimes struggle against low blocks. And Arsenal and Liverpool in the league this season too, similar struggle sometimes. The Everton game is more interesting, right? Because Dyche has his teams defend sometimes in a quite unique way. I call it a high block, right? Not a high press, a high block. So they're defending very passively, but they're defending passively from way up the pitch. And this season, Spurs, when they've had their first choice sort of back five, as it were, I'm including the keeper there, when they've had their first choice back five and defensive midfielder, have been just absolutely phenomenal under pressure, inviting pressure onto them, accepting 1v1 situations and coming out on top of those, breaking into the space behind. All season, outstanding when we're pressed, and the recent run of games has been a series of us waiting to be pressed, right, basically. But the Everton game, because of the way Dyche has his team set up, they come forward to us, we try to play fast, play diagonally, and break, but actually Everton haven't overcommitted in that situation. Actually, Everton are very much present in the play and have several players back. And I feel like that's probably the game where I'd say, like, tactically we were outdone here by the way that Dyche has his team play, which is to provoke the fast break without actually being vulnerable to the fast break. The thing with saying that we're vulnerable to that is, like, who's gonna recreate Dycean high block defending on a weekend basis, you know?
Yeah, and something you've alluded to in that answer actually is the fact that teams have tried to press you a little bit more in second halves, and those have been the halves when you've really been able to score goals. So a lot of games where you've struggled to break teams down in the first half, second half has come around, something has changed, and Spurs have had periods in particular, like short periods of time, where they've scored a lot of goals in quick succession. Why do you think that is? Do you think that's simply just teams becoming impatient at having to just sit deep against you the whole time?
Yeah, this is something I've sort of been wondering about, right? Trying to understand the psychology of it. So yeah, we've had the Brentford game, the Palace game and the Villa game, in which the first half has been difficult as a Spurs fan. The opposition have sat low and often narrow, and just made the game quite boring. And then second half, they've come out, tried to press us, and that's when the floodgates have just completely opened, and we've blown those teams away. I mean, obviously, like, those teams have come with that plan in mind, and a lot of it is like just fitness management. We're only going to press for a half. We'll pick the second half. That's not uncommon. But for some reason, the pattern is repeating. Teams aren't learning that lesson. And maybe they will, and you know, maybe Wolves showed the way, commit to the low block. But I think that is a hard thing to do, like, psychologically. I think it's physically and mentally exhausting. I think it's egotistically exhausting, right? To Spurs, let's not kid ourselves, haven't been the best team in the world over the last 5 years. So maybe there's a bit of an ego hit there to say we've just got to bunker in and pray for a lucky break and a 1-0 win by sitting in our own box for 97 minutes. That's like a tough thing to do, right? I wonder whether Ange Postecoglou, this is something that he's alluded to, maybe would say teams are having to come out and press in the second half because they're so threatened and they're so exhausted by the first half performance that Spurs put up, where we have 75% of the ball.
Do you think that there's anything in the fact that obviously in between a first half and a second half you have a half-time talk? Do you think that what is happening is that solutions are being found at half-time, or do you just think that it's the way that the game state has gone that Spurs have been able to actually find those weaknesses in the second half?
Yeah, I don't think Spurs are doing much different first half to second half. And which isn't to say that we don't see tweaks, because like all throughout the season, Spurs have met again mainly in build-up play. Found solutions to the way the opposition have pressed, mm-hmm. tweaks things up. Really, these games are about what the opposition have changed at halftime. The idea that Postecoglou has been like, you know, go out there and try harder in the second half, and then they have done. It's very evident that the opposition have come out to press, and that's been their undoing. That it's given space for Spurs to play through and break through and get in on goal with our front three of players who are all good at running in behind. And that's really the difference, rather than anything that we've done. Not that I've noticed, anyway.
In the period since we last recorded, there has also been a transfer window. What have you made of the two transfer windows in the Ange era so far, from a big picture point of view?
Big picture, clearly a significant improvement in our general approach, right? Clearly a much more analytically driven approach, clearly a much more top down. Now we have a director of football in place, but even before that, one where the coach isn't the be-all and end-all of recruitment, and is happy to work under an existing structure. I mean, the squad has absolutely improved, and especially the first 11. You know, identifying the weaknesses in the summer: goalkeeper, left centre-back, creative midfielder, done. It's been a point of frustration for me, as you know, that we haven't brought in a 1v1 specialist winger, because I think that would really massively help us against the low block, something that we're missing, and would make those games that we referenced, Brentford, Palace, Villa, perhaps even more one-sided, or one-sided from an earlier point in the game at least. So that's been frustrating. And then to see us, like, for example, bring in Timo Werner to play as a winger, when that happened, I was like, okay, I mean, good business, because he's on a loan with an option, and the option is cheap, and he's obviously a good player despite the perception of him in the Premier League, but this isn't addressing this need that we have. And so a little bit of frustration there, but actually he's come in, he's kind of done an okay job of the wingers that we have. He's probably done the best job of taking on his man. So fair play to him, you know, as someone who's played most of his career as a number nine. Hmm. We also brought in a third choice centre-back, which was a clear need with the injury to Van de Ven. I still have a few concerns about Dragusin on the ball. But again, the idea of the physical profile is an obvious exact match. The age profile is what we should be looking at. Someone who's happy to come in and be third choice in the meantime, you know, everything else, a lot of boxes are being ticked here. The other thing that we did is we shuffled around a bunch of loans that weren't working in the first half of the season, which is good to see us being proactive with that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the 1v1 specialist, because it has become a bit of a meme at this point that you're always talking about getting in a two-way winger who can really add to the Ange system. But the question I would put to you, I suppose, is that it's easy to say what they need to do is bring in a 1v1 specialist, but almost uniquely 1v1 specialists are going to be very expensive. And so do you think that there's a sense in which Spurs always were going to have to wait to get to a point where they were going to be good enough as a base level to be able to tempt the sort of 1v1 specialist who will cause a lot of problems for opponents? Or do you think that there has just been the inability so far for Spurs to pick up the kind of player who is going to cause those problems?
Yeah, I try not to kid myself and get myself too excited, right? But I like to imagine that, as you say, we recognize that this is a super important profile, and also, as you say, not a cheap profile. And we're going, right, that's second summer. That's a big portion of summer two's budget. We need a player of a first 11 quality. They don't come cheap. They're really important. Whereas summer one, like, we're missing a centre back, we're missing a goalkeeper, we're missing a creative midfielder. So let's get that done and push everything else back. Others may argue, well, we brought in Brennan Johnson and we brought in Timo Werner, so maybe he doesn't want a player who dribbles his man. My suspicion is that that's what we'll be looking at in the summer. Mm. We have been linked to the likes of Pedro Neto, for example. So I suspect, yeah, that's probably where we're going to be going in the summer.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about something that we talked about a lot last summer, which was that one of the difficulties for squad building for Spurs was the fact they'd had a back three manager more recently than the new manager at that point. And it's very hard to just reconstitute a back three squad, a squad that's built for a back three system, into a squad that works with a back four system. Something that we've not really talked about that much, I don't think, I say we in the general sense here, is how much of do you think that, because it feels to me as though the squad now, those issues that we talked about very early on about how do you fit, you know, wing backs into fullback slots, and can Pedro Porro play as a fullback, etc., both of which I think both of us were pretty skeptical about his fit in that kind of role. But how much do you think that actually bringing in a coach like Ange Postecoglou, who uses his fullbacks in such a unique way, actually helped overcome some of the issues that you might have had with a back three squad usually?
Oh, I don't think it does at all, to be honest. I think it's the opposite. I think that, you know, to ask Pedro Porro, a player who for me was like, is this guy too attacking minded to even be like a wing back in the Premier League, mm-hmm. to turn him into a inverted fullback? Less the case through Doggy, because I think he was actually the opposite. He was playing as a wing back despite being born to play inverted fullback. Yeah, I mean, like, this just hasn't come up as a concern at all. And I think that's a real testament to Postecoglou's coaching. Mm-hmm. That, like, yeah, I didn't even... There have been no back three to back four teething problems at all. It has been a total non-issue, despite the fact that it is one extreme to the other in terms of the profile of the widest defenders. But yeah, also what you're asking from your centre-backs, obviously we've moved out two centre-backs essentially from the first 11 and brought Van de Ven in. It was never too shocking that Romero would adjust. I guess, I'll take that back, because I think that there were concerns. Romero's too aggressive to play in a back two. But... Yeah, again, a real testament to Postecoglou's coaching, Porro's total 180 as a player.
And I guess the area where it has been an issue is when Udogie and Porro haven't been available, and then you had to bring in Ben Davis and Emerson Royale, I guess, in those spaces. So how important for you, I mean, we're moving on to the questions about depth here, but like, how important for you is it to find profiles of players who can play in those backup slots for the fullbacks?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because I always put together a scouting list for Spurs for each window, and I haven't got started on the fullbacks yet, because it's tough to know whether we should be looking at a backup left back, a backup right back, players who are going to spend a lot of time on the bench next season, although probably anticipating European football, or whether we should be looking for like a can do both sides in one player. It's a tough profile, like. As you say, like, when we go down from Pedro Porro to Emerson Royale, is significant. When we go down from Destiny Udogie to Ben Davies, it's a significant drop off and really affects the way that we play in that we want to invite pressure, right? Like those two, they aren't bad players, right? And obviously, when I'm saying that, that's even within the context of the Premier League, right? So I've got to find players of a technical level who are essentially brilliant, right? To be backup, that's a tough find. Not an impossible find by any means. I think there's a chance we might have to accept a shortcoming somewhere else in their ability. So maybe defensively, maybe athletically, in order to find a player of that necessary technical level to come in and play backup. For example, Spurs apparently have been linked back to Kai Walker-Peters, former Spurs Academy graduate, who's a technical, both-sided player. Someone like that perhaps might be the way that Spurs go. Or I'm wrong, we are able to find something close to a complete package, but it's a 20-year-old in the Championship, for example.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
One more thing on the transfer side of things. You mentioned, I think, on a recent episode of the Extra Inch, your podcast, that the PSR reality that we find ourselves in, the financial world of modern football, actually suits Spurs quite well. Spurs were one of the few clubs who could spend money in this window, the January window that we're talking about, because of the way that the club has been managed financially. Do you see that as being it's obviously an upside for Spurs to be able to manage their expenditure. But do you think that this could prove to be like the kind of upside that allows you to challenge at the top of the table?
I would hope so. It's tough here because it's like, how much is what I believe and what I say here because I'm a Spurs fan, and how much of it is my genuine, you know, disconnected from bias opinion about football. I think that I believe that, clubs should be not run at huge losses. I think that football should be an even playing field, in that you earn with what you achieve on the pitch and nothing outside of that. Also, that happens to line up perfectly with the way that Spurs have operated, and most is more of an advantage to Spurs than any other team in the league, I'm pretty sure. I think currently it stands that City also have an enormous financial leeway, but obviously asterisks will be applied in common perception over how legitimate that is, and we'll see whether that legitimacy stands over the next few years. Obviously, if City continue spending at the rate that they do, that doesn't give much of an advantage to Spurs, right? But if things change there, then yeah, it's just like the spending caps are just not a consideration for Spurs at all. It's not even, whereas every other club now, I think, again, except maybe City, are having to sort of do some maths, having to think things through and thinking about selling off academy players because they can't go down as pure profit. That just isn't even in consideration at all for Spurs. which, yeah, I think is the way that football should be going. But again, maybe that's just because I'm a Spurs fan.
Yeah, no doubt. Let's just round out this section with just a question about how you expect the rest of the season to go. Because at the time of recording, we still have 11 Premier League games left. The weekend fixture versus Fulham will have taken place by the time this episode goes out. Spurs have no other competitions to compete in. Champions League seems nailed on now, as we said, with that win against Villa. So what are you expecting from the rest of the season? Like, what is it that you want to see from the team and the club in the rest of the games that are remaining?
Yeah, top four finish would be good, obviously. Champions League next season, we're very keen on that. I think always the thing with this is like you come in with a great mood. You talk about how excellent things are. We lose to Fulham. The podcast goes out on Wednesday. You know, everyone gets injured and suspended.
Yeah.
It's tough. But like, yeah, our running includes Newcastle away, City at home, Arsenal at home, Liverpool away, right? That's a tough running. Those are back-to-back-to-back-to-back games close to the end. So that's a tough run in terms of points. But I'm not scared of them. I'm excited for them because I think that we're playing really good football. And yeah, football is what it's about still this season. Obviously, yeah, we want top four. We want Champions League next season. That puts us in good stead for summer spending, for example. But more than that, obviously, as we just talked about, spending isn't really an issue. It's more about attracting players and the message to ourselves, right? Rebuilding that confidence. Hey, we're back to being a Champions League team again, right? But beyond that, what matters over the course of the season is showing the good football that we're going to play. And if the results don't come in that run of games, or actually they do come in that run of games, but we trip up against Luton, West Ham, Burnley or whatever, it's okay as long as the performance is good, as long as we're showing our good football. Ideally, some kind of evolution, while we don't have that 1v1 specialist in the squad, some kind of tactical evolution of other ways to create goals against teams who sit deep with, you know, better off-ball movement or better set pieces, I think.
Let's move on then to talk about the tactics, the fun part here, because I think it's, yeah, in the 6 months since we've last recorded, I'm interested to hear whether or not you would say you've changed your mind on anything about Ange Postecoglou's tactical approach, because I remember having conversations with you back in the summer before any of this had become a reality, and there were certain things that we were concerned about, other things that we thought would suit the Premier League quite well. And I think arguably certainly on my account, I've maybe misread some of the things that could be problems and undervalued some of the things that could be good. So what about yourself? What are the things that stick out to you about, and it doesn't even need to be saying, oh, I was wrong, but just being pleasantly surprised by Ange Postecoglou's football in the Premier League?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, coming into the season before we recorded the previous podcast, the concerns were the high pressing game in terms of overcommitting forwards and leaving centre-backs too far back. We press very differently to the way that Celtic press, it turns out. So, problem solved. Like, right from the off. Or maybe the Brentford game, it wasn't quite there. And then since then, sorry, that was first game of the season, by the way. Since then, very, very happy with our out-of-possession play. Both like settled defence and counter-pressing. We still get caught out a little bit in our counter-pressing and very specifically the quick switch after a throw-in is something that will catch us out again and again. Don't tell anyone, please don't listen to this podcast, people. But yeah, I mean, I think, again, you look back at Celtic, which is what I was doing in the summer, and going, oh, well, obviously they spend all season facing low block after low block after low block. So that's where we're expecting to be strong. Whereas they very rarely get pressed. I'm slightly worried about a build-up play. The reality has been the opposite. I think our build-up play is as good as City's, as good as Brighton's, as good as anyone's in the league. Not just in terms of like technical players, obviously that too, but like live problem solving with the positioning of our fullbacks, positioning of our midfielders, rotation of our players, change up in directness of approach, all kinds of various answers to teams pressing us, including like against Brighton, James Maddison dropping all the way back into defence to drag a centre-back with him and things like that. So build-up play, like honestly, you know, 10 out of 10, essentially.
I always think that whenever teams are completely changing the way they play against you because of build-up, then that means you've got good build-up, right? It's like the perfect bellwether that you're doing things right.
Yeah. And then whereas the opposite end is, the low block game has been a bit of a struggle. Maybe that's just because we're lacking the profile of a 1v1 specialist. Maybe we should be finding solutions anyway. Without them, we should be using movements and combinations and rotations in the final third. I guess the other thing is that we were just kind of generally expecting a slow start, and there wasn't a slow start. There was a slow middle as we suffered a bunch of injuries, international tournament absentees and suspensions.
I guess I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on whether or not there's been much evolution in the last 6 months from a tactical point of view. Have you seen anything where you thought, Postecoglou has actually changed a little bit here? Or has it just been pretty much the same all the way through?
Yeah, again, it's the pressing thing, right? Because Celtic pressed in the 4-4-2. They committed their two centre-forwards onto the opposition centre-backs. Sometimes, obviously, the technical level of teams outside of the top two in Scotland isn't great, but sometimes they're able to find their number six and find solutions there. Certainly, that showed up in the Champions League for Celtic. Whereas, people who are non-Spurs fans probably don't know that Postecoglou doesn't bring his assistant coaches with him from the previous club to his next club. He works with what talent is available there, and he also delegates a lot. So he tends to delegate a significant portion of the defensive game to his new coaches. Mm-hmm. At Spurs, Mila Jedinak, who listeners will remember from his time at Palace. Mila Jedinak is our defensive coach. He's also working with Matt Wells, who's the analyst/coach. And they have created a pressing scheme that is, again, quite different to the way that Celtic played. But again, that was like a game week two adaptation and has stayed that way since. Mm. There hasn't really been an evolution over the season. We hit the ground running, things got difficult for a while, and now we're back up and running again without really any significant tweaks to the way we're playing. What we see is game-to-game tweaks and mid-game tweaks and adaptations to the opposition.
Yeah, and it's worth maybe dwelling on that for a little while, because I think it's fair to say that Postecoglou is an idealistic coach, right? He has his idea of how football is going to be played, and he wants his teams to adhere to that, regardless of the game state, often. And that does raise questions. We saw similar things happening with Marcelo Bielsa when he was in the Premier League as well. Questions raised about if a manager doesn't have a plan B, then are they really justified being managers in our wonderful, glorious Premier League? But obviously, there always has to be a level of pragmatism, right? Even if it's within that plan A. And I wondered if you have any concerns that you feel as though Postecoglou would never compromise on his ideals, or whether or not you think there is still plenty of scope within those ideals to have that maybe more pragmatic approach in certain games.
Yeah, sometimes, like we mentioned the Everton game, and that was one where, like, I think we were a goal up for a period of time. Is that right? We were a goal up close to the end, and Everton kept provoking us to go all out on the sprint. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we were 2-1 up from half time, essentially, and Everton kept provoking us to go all out, to really break hard, and that exhausted us and made it a back and forth game, and Everton got the last minute equalizer, and it's like, maybe in those games we could like knock it back to the keeper and keep the ball a little bit sometimes, but other than that, it's like, because fundamentally the attack in football works, right? If we were just sending loads of players forwards and not being effective in attack, then maybe there'd be concerns. But it's kind of very Spurs, right? To dare is to do, right? Attack in football, that's what we're about. And I think that, okay, we might drop points here and there, but for the most part, there's such a buy-in from the players, from the fans, that this is who we are, this is what we're about. We're about attacking beyond the need to attack and accepting that sometimes you can get caught out. That's just the way we lean anyway. And I think that probably showed in in the failures of Mourinho and Conte is that fundamentally as a club, we don't want to sit back. We don't want to see a game out. We want to attack and play football. And yeah, a couple of times we're going to get caught out like that. A couple of times we're going to commit too many players forward when we don't even need to because we're already a goal up. That's okay because this football resonates with us, I think.
Are you saying that even in the 2-2 draws with Everton, there is an echo of glory?
I am saying there's an echo of glory, yeah.
Let's just push on that outlier aspect a little bit as well, because I feel as though Spurs are pretty big outliers in terms of the way that they play. We've already mentioned that, like, Postecoglou has this really aggressive approach to football where he's not wanting to change things up, even if the game state changes. So, like we were talking with Everton, you're a goal up with you know, 30 minutes to go. Do you need to constantly attack the whole time? Well, for Postecoglou, yes, you do need to attack the whole time. That means that you would end up becoming quite an outlier, I think, in the Premier League, because a lot of the other elite teams would be super game state managed and would probably try and change things up to make it, to manage the game to try and get it to the end and get all of those points. I always think when teams are outliers, it always means that they are quite vulnerable to tactical I want to say nullification, but just other teams recognizing where the weaknesses lie and then finding ways to solve that. And I think often if you're an outlier, you get the upside of that in the first season. So again, we already talked about Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds in that first season. They were able to, teams were coming up against them and being like, oh, this is just a promoted side. We can just play our game against them and we'll generally win. And then in the second season, obviously things changed a little bit because opponents realized that, you know, you can destabilize a man marking system quite easily by doing these two simple things. And I wondered whether or not you think that that's a fair characterization of what's going on with Spurs, that they are an outlier because they do things so differently. And if that is the case, whether or not you're getting a bounce this season that maybe next season will drop off a bit if analysts spend the whole summer thinking, right, how do we stop Spurs from having the incredible build-up that they have? How do we find ways of stopping them from breaking down low blocks? Do you think that's potentially a reality?
It's not the way that I feel. Because I feel like right now it's like, okay, when Spurs are lacking some of their first choice players, press them because they'll rush even though they're not at a high enough technical level to rush and you can catch them out there. When Spurs have all of their players with them, commit to the low block, try to get a turnover at 87 minutes as Bissouma tries to dribble through a packed midfield and get the break that way. Those are the ways in which we've found out this season. To me, obviously, I've got an optimistic viewpoint here, but I feel like we will find solutions to depth issues by increasing our depth. We'll find solutions to the low block by bringing in a dribbler. Again, I mentioned like the way that Everton pressed, which is to provoke fast plays without yourself committing. I think that's a tough thing to try to pick up on the fly to play against Spurs. You know, maybe if we're talking about like a quarter final, a semi final, maybe that's, and you've got a week to work with and you're a high level opposition, maybe that's something that you work with. But I can't think of a way that should cause us significant problems going forward. Like this season, we've seen teams play with a narrow back five, so that our front five are all picked up. But I think that only goes so far. I think that when you commit to a back five, you open up other weaknesses elsewhere. Maybe that's what we saw against Villa to an extent. And again, when you create 1v1s across the back line, if in the future Spurs have a winger who's very good at beating their man, getting to the byline, etc., then that's a risk of its own. So I agree with the idea that like Spurs have an incredibly almost ludicrously attacking approach to all games, and within that there are some innate weaknesses. You can take advantage of that mentality. But that's not, I don't really see that as a tactical thing, right? I don't see a particular tactical solution to playing against Spurs, certainly going forward with the right profiles added.
Yeah, and I suppose following on from that then, the question that will be on everyone's mind is, will Spurs challenge for the Premier League title playing this style of football? And I guess that comes down to maybe consistency a little bit more. I'm thinking maybe the difference between Arsenal last season versus Arsenal this season, where in many respects, you know, Arsenal were incredibly attacking last season and got a huge amount of upside from that. Whereas this season, you could argue that their in possession side is slightly lower than it was last time out. But because they're able to control all phases of the game, particularly in the out of possession phases, that makes them more consistent and therefore better suited to challenge for the Premier League. Do you have the same kind of concern maybe with Spurs, or do you think that that's a bridge that you cross when you get there? And if you become constant sort of Champions League spot finishers, then the question will be, well, how do we then kick up to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with your analysis of Arsenal in terms of them becoming more of a defensively orientated team. The other thing is they also sort of became stratospheric with their set pieces, right? And I think that if Spurs can recreate that, then we don't need to prioritize control as much as they do. If you can put the ball in the net, you win games, you know. Again, for me, I don't think that we need another element to our play. I think we just need a couple more profiles in our squad, and set pieces on top of that would really round things out. Yeah.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Yeah, interesting hearing you mention set pieces, because we've just seen Bernardo Cueva go from Brentford to Chelsea. And Ange Postecoglou has made some interesting comments about set pieces in the last few weeks. Do you think that's a weak? That is one weakness in his game. He doesn't seem to see the value of bringing in a set piece analyst or coach. Or do you think that, again, he would be happy changing with that if once he sees the data that I think you put out a viz that showed just how many teams who have, you know, dedicated set piece coaches are getting a massive upside in terms of attacking production from them?
Yeah, I guess it's probably related to his preference to work with the coaches that are already at a club and train them and educate them and work with them. But it is a bit of a point of frustration for me, because I think that he spoke about wanting set pieces to be tied into the way that we play in open play. But I just don't see things that way. I think that, like, again, we talked about being like an incredibly attacking minded in everything we do, super aggressive team. But at the moment, we defend with 11 players on corners, right? So there isn't an increased need there to maintain a connection to the way you play out of play. I also think if you talk to your set piece specialist, you can achieve those same things. I'm very jealous of Chelsea landing Bernardo Cueva. So that is a point of frustration for me. But I kind of get, you know, betting on the coaches at the club, hoping that Mason and Jedinak respectively develop their ability to coach attacking and defensive set pieces. That'd be really good if they became, you know, high level in their ability to do that. I think probably also I would, to be fair, say Spurs at the moment, the squad isn't the best collection of jumpers and headers, and that obviously is going to undermine, especially defensively, any work that a coach is doing.
And it's worth saying as well, Everton are really flying in terms of their set pieces at the moment, and their set piece coaches are their assistants, Steve Stone and Ian Wone. So there's definitely the possibility that you can have assistant coaches who do set pieces on the side be very, very good set piece coaches as well.
And similar for Liverpool over the last several years, right?
I believe so. Let's move on and start thinking. Actually, no, I've got one more question before we move on, because I've just got a question here about Spurs injuries. We've seen Mickey van de Ven go down seemingly every other week because of his hamstring is being put through the most pressure that a human hamstring has ever been put through. And there have been other injuries that have cropped up in playing the way that, that Spurs play. And just wondered what you thought of the links between the tactical approach and the amount of pressure that's put on these players' bodies. Is that like a long-term concern for you? Because I guess then you have to start thinking in sort of three season cycles in terms of a squad, where you have to make sure that you are churning through your players in order to be able to have the fitness and athleticism to be able to compete continuously.
I do suspect they're interlinked in that you've got a player, like you say, in Van de Ven, who several times a game from the halfway line has to turn on a dime and sprint backwards. And by the way, he's incredible at it. He's a freak of nature. But yeah, him doing that a bunch, and then also having repeated hamstring injuries, probably, I'm not a medical expert, but seems like that would probably be related in some way, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, this was, again, this has been a bit of a trend with Postecoglou, certainly at Celtic. In his first season at Celtic, there were a bunch of hamstring injuries, and he spoke at the time of it just being a period of adaptation and things will be fine. And then second season, far fewer injuries. So, again, I don't really understand if that's just about developing fast twitch muscle or whatever. I don't really understand the process there, but certainly there's a pattern that points to positive things. I also think having improved depth will help with that. Obviously, we'll have probably more games next season. At the moment, we have one backup centre back who's going to get a good game in now, at least, hopefully, get a good look at him. But yeah, probably going to need some increased depth there in order to save Van de Ven's hamstrings.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting from a tactical point of view that, you know, the trend in modern football is to try and get as many players forward as possible in attacking phases. And the way that you do that is by having players who can defend those situations if there is a turnover of the ball. So no surprise that for me that Arsenal have William Saliba playing for them at the moment and are able to do this, right? One of the best backwards defenders in the world, and Mickey van der Ven is in that same range, I would say, of a player who you can defend with two centre backs, with Romero and van der Ven, in a way that maybe other teams would prefer to have three just to be safe, and that just gives you an extra player in attack as well. So I suppose the two things are linked a little bit with it. If you're playing with two centre backs in those rest defense moments, you're putting a huge amount of pressure physically on two players. And if you lose one of them, it could affect the way that you might want to play in possession as well. So yeah, I just wondered if any concerns there with the fact that you then need reliably athletic centre-backs, both for the way that you play, but also because if you probably won't have a depth of those kind of profile of players anyway, right?
Yeah, it's tough. And also, like Dragusin, who we brought in, I spoke about how I have some concerns over his technical play. Maybe we'll see how that goes. But he is very clearly, we've prioritized there another physical outlier. And that seems to be the way that we are certainly profiling our centre backs, physical specimens first and footballer second. Yeah. Not to say that Van de Ven isn't also an exceptional footballer.
Sure.
Yeah, that's definitely the way we're going.
Well, let's move on then to just round things out. I do want to talk, before we finish, we've talked a lot about what's happening on the pitch, but I think it's worth mentioning some of the stuff that's happening off the pitch as well. You've mentioned already that the tactical style that Ange Postecoglou plays resounds with the Spurs way, the way that Spurs fans want their team to play. And that aspect is clearly important. I think maybe it's becoming less important in the world of modern football, where everything becomes about winning. But there is something to be said about having a coach who embodies, you know, a fan base's ideas about what football should be, what it should look like, how it should be played. How important do you think that aspect is in terms of actually building a team that can compete? Because I remember talking with you and Charlie in the previous episode about how Postecoglou's attitude almost meant that the segue between some of the coaches that you've had in the past, and most recently Antonio Conte, into a coach who is much more positive about things. Who, I remember we talked in that podcast about how Harry Kane went, and any other elite manager would probably come in and be annoyed that they joined a club where they just sold the best player. And yeah. Ange just sort of took it in his stride and was like, this is something that's going to happen. We're just going to move on. We're going to get past this. And almost that attitude meant that Spurs had a really quick start in the league. So yeah, this is a really broad question, but I'm interested to hear how you think like personality is important, not just in terms of like reflecting what the club's values are or whatever, or the fans' values are, but also just in terms of the play style as well, that when you have a coach who's positive, it results in positive football on the field as well.
Yeah, positive in very much his tactical approach, positive in the way that he speaks, the way that he speaks is really, really hits with me. And I think it hits with a lot of other Spurs fans too. You know, calm confidence with regards to Spurs, but also just speaks so well on social issues and concussion substitutions and fan perspective and all those kinds of things. That all ties in, right? Positive vibes and positive football. It came out in the last couple of weeks that Richarlison argued with Conte about how negative his football was, how much he disliked the formation they were playing and so on, which is quite funny. I do increasingly get the feeling that like there's something fundamental about Tottenham and a rejection of defensive football and an adoration of attacking football, that is, it's just something fundamental that runs through the fan base and therefore affects what happens on the pitch. Maybe other fans feel that way about their club too, but I do think that the failures of Mourinho and Conte point to that somewhat. It just so happens to be the case that the sort of meta tactical arc of football right now leans towards favouring attacking football, which is convenient. And hopefully those two things can marry for Spurs now, and we can turn that into trophies.
It's worth saying as well, like you mentioned Richarlison. Richarlison, a player who Postecoglou's almost certainly got more out of than the previous managers have managed to. And again, that comes down to the ability to man-manage. It is a super important quality. And I think, especially in modern football, we see that from Jurgen Klopp, right? Jurgen Klopp, even this season, where you can look at Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool and point to tactical flaws.
Yeah.
They get through those flaws because the team are behind him. He plays young players and inspires the belief on the part of those young players to be able to perform in a senior situation, and they don't miss a beat on these things. And I think that, you know, it's unarguable that Postecoglou has got more out of players who maybe haven't been loved by the Spurs fan base in the past. I guess we could throw Yves Bissouma in there as well. Maybe he's dropped off a little bit more recently, but like when he first came in, we saw the impact that, you know, having a positive manager who is willing to work for the players and get the players into a positive mindset where they can go onto the pitch and perform it adds value to your football club as well. So yeah, I think the era of maybe negative coaches is passing away. And you know, we talk about Mourinho a lot in this episode. Mourinho is a coach who will throw his players under the bus in certain scenarios, and often that presages like a decline and an eventual sacking on his part. Whereas what we're seeing now more, I think, is positive coaches who recognise the fact that you can get more out of your players by adopting this sort of more positive mindset.
Yeah, and with that, you're right to point out like a shift of the usage of the squads towards some of our younger players, our more attacking players. So, you know, you mentioned Bissouma, Saar, and then also Richarlison, who struggled to get the minutes that he wanted last season. Saar especially, as just being like a non-factor last season, right? A lot of that is like a coach who respects young players, who is willing to work with, you know, imperfect players and coach them. Porro transformed not in his ability, but in his profile. All speaks to like a great long-term process, combining that with smart recruitment of young players, a coach who works with young players. This is all tick, 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 right? But then also like on top of that, you take the opposite, right? Højbjerg was the first 11 player last season. Someone who, maybe this is harsh on him as a player, but you might characterize as being sort of stodgy and defensively minded and winning mentality, for example, perhaps is
I've heard him described as a cement mixer in the past.
So I have heard such things being said, a cement mixer of a player. He's not first 11 this season, but that doesn't mean that he is discarded. That doesn't mean that he is spoken badly of in press conferences. That doesn't mean that he's shut out of first team training, because he still offers us something coming on as a substitute, giving us tactical solutions in changing the shape of our midfield, giving us depth, giving us legs. We may well sell Højbjerg in the summer. It looks like that's what our intention is, because his contract is running down. He's an aging player. We want to change our profiles. but with Postecoglou, make use of the squad that you have. That's certainly what he's done.
And any thoughts on like individual, you know, player improvements where it's clearly down to coaching as well, which raises the value of players and therefore the squad. And I guess it's a quality which is intrinsic to good management. To be able to take players and make them better at what they do. Some of that, I suppose, comes down to the system, and we've talked at length about how, particularly with Richarlison, the system suits him because the system provides chances that Richarlison can score. But there's definitely an individual element to that as well, right? Where you have coaches working on the training ground with the players, making them better, improving them at their job, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, these are worth talking about on an individual basis. Like, Sarr is better because he's playing minutes, right? And that's what he needed, minutes in a game of football where he sees the football, right? Mm-hmm. Richarlison is doing better because there are chances being put on for him in the box, and that's what he's good at. Whereas Pedro Porro, again, I've got to keep bringing him up, has been remolded as a very different player to the player that he was. Very different things are asked of him in and out of possession. Obviously, the technical quality is relevant in both the way he plays now and the way he played before, but his overall role within the team is dramatically different. That speaks to excellent coaching work, I think. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of the others are just like, if you play good attacking football and have the ball a lot, players look better, basically.
Mm-hmm. We ended the last podcast that we recorded together by talking about the longer term future of Postecoglou at Spurs, and we were talking about whether or not we see Postecoglou as a coach who can instill a project which is going to last for a number of seasons now. And you and Charlie were both, I think, pretty positive about the future in that respect. We're 6 months on. Postecoglou is doing that now, right? He is the project manager. He is making the club in his own image. We're seeing improvements at every different level of the club, not just in terms of results, as we said, but in terms of processes and structures and performances. So you must be pretty happy. Like, this is you envisage this being a long-term project where the progress is going to be upwards.
Yeah. Basically, I think, And Postecoglou was keen to point out that, like, when questioned, he has a history of winning competitions, right? And I think that for him, you know, whereas we talked about Mourinho, we talked about Conte, like, winning mentality, grinding out results against performances, all these kinds of things, leaders, all of that stuff. Postecoglou will win games because he wins games, right? Because taking it a game at a time and going into those and playing the better football and creating the better chances, that wins games, and winning games wins tournaments.
Well, Nathan, I could have talked for much longer with you about these topics, and I always enjoy talking about Spurs. If our listeners want to catch what you're putting out in terms of Spurs content, you are on Twitter at Nathan A. Clark, and your podcast is called The Extra Inch. Well, recommend checking that out. They do a free weekly podcast, so if you want to keep up with what Spurs are doing, do make sure you check them out. That's The Extra Inch. But Nathan, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, mate.